The program covers all discharges of wastewater into surface waters.
The state wins a court decision for wastewater permit authority. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state election officials lay out the plan for next week's count.
The Division of Elections will be making calls on if a ballot is or is not counted, with consultation from folks from our Department of Law.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
An interstate drug trafficking and money laundering investigation by a law enforcement task force has led to the arrest of 19 Alaskans. Federal prosecutors unsealed charges today after the investigation through the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force. KDLL's Ben Stanton reports.
The arrests include 6 people from Kenai, 9 from Soldotna, and 1 each from Anchor Point, Sterling, Wasilla, and Anchorage. The investigation also led to the arrest of 8 Nevada residents. The total of 27 defendants face a variety of charges, all stemming from the alleged distribution of oxycodone that started in June of 2009. U.S. Attorney for the state of Nevada, Daniel Bogdan, indicates the distribution network involved the sale of over 6,000 tablets of oxycodone and money laundering of $1.2 million. The drug oxycodone is a painkiller that requires a prescription to obtain legally. According to Bogdan's office, the network was based in Las Vegas, where several co-conspirators acquired the pills under several names. Others, including Alaskans, carried the drugs on commercial air flights to Alaska, where they were sold. Money from the sales was transmitted back to Nevada. A leader of the network allegedly used a custom motorcycle and paint shop business in Nevada to attempt to legitimize the illegal income. Investigation involved work from nearly 24 city, state, and federal agencies. The 19 Alaskans are detained in Alaska and have initial appearances in court over the next week. If convicted, they face 20 years in prison and a $1 million fine for the drug trafficking and 20 years and $500,000 for the money laundering charge. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
The state of Alaska has won the right to issue Clean Water Act wastewater discharge permits for mines, despite a legal challenge from environmental groups and some Alaska Native tribes. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Yesterday, the United States Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals approved a transfer of the Environmental Protection Agency permitting authority to the State Department of Environmental Conservation. Governor Sean Parnell called the decision an important case for Alaska because it ensures that the state has primacy in decisions about how to use its natural resources, while it gives better public access to government decision makers. Cam Leonard is a state attorney.
Well, it's a permitting program under the Federal Clean Water Act that allows states to take over the issuing of the permits, and most states in the country have already done so. Alaska is actually the 46th state to take over that program, and the program covers all discharges of wastewater into surface waters, so that would include not just industrial wastewater, like you might imagine from mines or oil and gas facilities, but domestic wastewater, like from municipal sewage treatment plants as well.
The transfer of the EPA permitting authority to the state actually began 2 years ago after the federal agency approved a request from the state. The transfer was arranged in 4 stages, starting with seafood processing plant and log transfer site discharges the first year, then moving to wastewater discharge permits for mines, which started this week. But a number of Alaska tribal governments, joined by environmental groups, petitioned the Ninth Circuit for a review of EPA's approval of the transfer, claiming the state is too easy on polluters. Among the plaintiffs is a coalition of Bristol Bay Native corporations and tribal governments in Dillingham and Non-Dalton.
They were exercising their right to petition the circuit court to review the final decision of a federal agency. In this case, the final decision was EPA's approval of the state program, which happened in October of 2008. So they brought what's called a petition for review, asking the Ninth Circuit to overturn EPA's approval.
But the Ninth Circuit decided this week that the EPA approval can stand. The court has ruled that the state has met all of the criteria required by federal law to assume responsibility for the program and dismissed the plaintiff's appeal. As a result, DEC will continue phasing in its authority under the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System program, including the permitting of regulated discharges from mines. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The Division of Elections is setting up what it needs to count the write-in ballots that were cast in Tuesday's general election. Elections Director Gail Fanoumiai says all the ballots will be counted in Juneau beginning Wednesday of next week and will take about 3 or 4 days.
We are having 15 counting teams, and each candidate or party and party is allowed to have one observer per table to observe the process, make any challenges along the way. So we could have 45 observers in the room at one time.
Working in pairs, Fanoumiai says the people actually counting the ballots are all experienced members of the division's hand count verification team. She says they have all been workers at polling places in the past and have been members of various election boards. And she says they have proven that they take their jobs very seriously.
They're going to be following our directions, and they're just going to be specifically sorting ballots and then doing the count. The Division of Elections will be making calls on if a ballot is or is not counted with consultation from folks from our Department of Law. Challenges can be made throughout the process.
Fanoumiai says there are today more than 43,000 ballots that have not been counted, including absentees, early votes, and question ballots. If those also include write-ins, they will be dealt with as they arise. The next run of absentee ballots will be done Tuesday, the 9th. Still, another count is expected on November 12th to deal with some of the question ballots. The final count of absentee ballots will be done on November 17th. The entire counting schedule faces a November 29th certification date. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering Master Trapper Dean Wilson Sr.
He strongly promoted trapping education and ethical standards for trappers.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Trappers are mourning the loss of Dean Wilson Sr. of Kenny Lake. The master trapper and fur buyer passed away earlier this week following a long illness. He was 69 years old. Wilson grew up in the village of Northway, learned to trap as a child, and spent his life working in the field and running a seasonal fur buying operation in Fairbanks. Alaska Trappers Association President Randy Zarnke says Wilson was known as the patriarch of Alaska trapping and did a lot to support the traditional activity, especially with kids.
He would buy red squirrels and muskrats and weasels from young kids at about 3 or 4 or 5 times the going rate, just to, you know, support them and encourage them to continue trapping.
Zarnke says Wilson's roots were in traditional trapping, but he embraced evolution of the craft.
Dean kind of bridged the gap between the real old timers that we think of, people from back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and he remembered them very fondly, and he spoke of how much he had learned from them. But then he also had his feet firmly planted in the present and looked to the future, where he strongly promoted trapping education and ethical standards for trappers.
Another longtime friend and fellow trapper, Pete Buist of Fairbanks, says Wilson was always willing to share his knowledge.
He would take and sit down with anybody, any new trapper, and tell them how to catch fur. He wasn't worried about competition.
Buist says Wilson will be remembered for his outgoing personality and sense of humor. Buist recounts a time when Wilson asked him to help promote a fur contest.
He says, "Well, I want you to tell people that I'm the largest fur buyer in Alaska." And I said, "Dean, I know there's people that are probably buying more fur than you are right now. How can you make a claim like that?" He says, "I weigh nearly 260 pounds. I'm sure I'm the largest fur buyer in Alaska."
The Alaska Trappers Association shared memories of Dean Wilson Sr. at its monthly meeting this week in Fairbanks. Wilson's funeral is scheduled for Sunday at the Kenny Lake School. Select populations of black bear in Southeast may be declining at a significant pace. That's according to multiple Fish and Game staff members who addressed the State Board of Game. The board began its five-day Southeast region meeting in Ketchikan today. Fish and Game Wildlife Management Coordinator Neil Barton says the state saw a sharp increase in black bear harvests in Southeast in the mid-90s.
I think a lot of that is because the economy was probably pretty good. People had the money and the income to probably come up here and spend a little more time on a vacation where they could come this far to go look for a bear. But also, I think once people got a taste of what they were doing with hunting black bears up here and kind of figured it out, a lot of the magazines started printing articles about black bear hunting. Come to Prince of Wales, come to QU Island, places like that, where you can get a big bear and you can see a number of bears in a day, and you can even do it yourself, kind of take yourself hunting with a group of friends. So it became very popular, and I think the momentum kind of hit, and people were able to come up here in droves and really target black bears.
In the last several years, Barton says, Fish and Game has noted a marked decline in the harvest rate of black bears on multiple islands within Southeast.
In the last number of years, with the increase in harvest, hunters, guides, residents, but certainly fish and game biologists as well, we've all started getting concerned about the numbers of black bears being taken, and are we taking too many? What is too many? And then in the last few years, we've seen a drop-off in harvest, and we're not exactly sure why. We are concerned that maybe that's because availability bears is down. Certainly could be economic as well, but it's an issue that we're going to be talking a lot about in the next 3-4 days.
While some black bear populations in Southeast appear to be faring well, Barton says Fish and Game is concerned about a population decline on QU and Kupreanof Islands. He says the highest concentration of black bear hunters has been on Prince of Wales Island, which has seen the largest drop in harvests. About 800 black bears were harvested last year in the region. Of those, 75% were taken by non-resident hunters. The apparent decline in the black bear population appears to have had a positive effect on the Prince of Wales deer population, which Fish and Game estimates is at a 15-year high. Of the 46 proposed game management changes the board is slated to take up, 19 deal with black bear. The Hollywood movie Everybody Loves Wales is taking center stage lately as film crews shoot in various locations around the state. But another movie, some of it shot in western Alaska, will be airing on television this month. And as KDLG's Adam Kane tells us, it stars a longtime Alaska resident, the Pacific Walrus.
3 years ago, a National Geographic film crew began an ambitious project to document a number of different types of animals around the world as they followed annual migration paths. The film crew traveled to more than 80 locations on all 7 continents to document the vivid imagery of migrating animals ranging from butterflies and birds to mammals and marine life, including the Pacific walrus, which was filmed in Alaska. Great Migrations is the largest cross-platform project ever undertaken by National Geographic. David Hamlin is a senior producer for National Geographic Television. He says the goal was to create an experience that really allows people to redefine their concept of animal migrations.
It's not just these beautiful, epic images. It is that, and we brought that home, you know, in dramatic fashion, I think. But it's also incredibly difficult, arduous journeys and narratives, and that every individual animal who undergoes these life or death struggles every year, they have amazing stories to tell and can give us a newfound appreciation for life on the move.
Hamlin says that in Alaska, the film crew wanted to tell a story that hadn't been told before.
That's the very trying circumstances and difficult migration of the Pacific walrus. This is a really interesting, charismatic creature, larger than the Atlantic walrus, which is where most of the filming of the species has happened, or of walrus has happened. The Pacific walrus is its own species.
Hamlin goes on to say that the new story that needs telling is one of climate change and how it is affecting the annual migration of Pacific walrus.
The problem in the last 5 years or so is that there is no more ice where it's traditionally been for the walrus. So the females and the pups are in dire circumstances. There's no place for them to go. So what they're doing is they have to sort of retrace their steps and go back and beach where the males are. And they're all sharing beaches now in just really sort of, frankly, horrifying numbers. You're getting 15, 20, 40,000 walruses stacked on top of each other on beaches, numbers that are not sustainable, have not occurred in at least human recorded experience. And the walruses are suffering. They're dying from stress and from crushing. It's a migration that is really changing right in front of our eyes.
Walrus in Alaska were filmed in the spring and summer as they made their way north to the Arctic. National Geographic is a scientific and research organization, and Hamlin says that the intent of the program was to educate and inspire people to care about the planet.
Every story that we did, all 20 different migrations over all seven continents, was very informed and often, you know, completely guided by the scientists, the folks who know the animals a lot better than the filmmakers. We learned from each other. And so we were instructed by the scientists of where to go, when to go. They often went with us in the field. But at the same time, we were able to deliver to them footage and things they've never seen before.
The Great Migration television series consists of 7 one-hour segments that will air weekly beginning this Sunday, November 7th, at 6 p.m. Alaska time on the National Geographic Channel. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
The city of Accutan continues to make progress on its geothermal energy project. For more than a year, the city has been working to turn the island's hot springs into a renewable energy resource. This summer, two exploratory wells have been drilled 1,500 feet into the earth at a site about 3 miles away from the town in Hot Spring Valley Bay. According to program manager Ray Mann, the results have been promising. Geologists have measured temperatures of about 360 degrees in the wells, hot enough to move forward with the project. Last week, Mann traveled to California to address the Geothermal Resources Council and talk about where the project stands and where it's going.
If everything went in an ideal way, we'd like to be out there next year, setting up for production drilling, getting the access there, and getting the area prepared to take in these large drill rigs and the equipment that we need to drill the production wells. And if that all came about next year, then we'd be prepared in 2012 to begin the production drilling, which would mean bringing a large drill rig out there, getting it into the valley, and commence drilling operations.
Right now, the project is estimated to cost $45 million, and it has largely been paid for with Alaska Renewable Energy funds and city money. Energy produced by the well could be enough to develop a 12-megawatt power system on the island. Accutan is part of the Eastern Aleutian Chain. It has a population of about 800 people, and it supports a major fish processing plant. The production of geothermal energy is expected to eliminate the need for heating fuel on the island. The project is expected to be online by 2012.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Richard Nelson, anthropologist and host of Encounters, is coming to Anchorage as part of the Alaska News Fund Speakers Series, bringing public broadcasting faces to Alaska. Richard Nelson will be in Anchorage at the Anchorage Museum Auditorium on Friday, November 12th. For ticket information, go to aprn.org or call 550-8400. Proceeds will benefit APRN Alaska News Fund.
Sea Alaska's fall dividends will total almost $10 million. The Juneau-based Regional Native Corporation will distribute the money to about 20,000 tribal members on December 3rd. Urban and at-large shareholders owning 100 shares will get $577 each. Village, descendant, and left-out shareholders will receive $120 each. Qualified elders will get another 120. Urban shareholders, who make up about 60% of the recipients, will get less than half the amount distributed last December. The end of 2009 payment was about $1,200. The difference in payments is money from a resource earnings pool funded by all regional Native corporations. Sealeska CEO Chris McNeil says this year's earnings are lower.
The revenues that Sealeska receives are principally from the zinc mine and from oil revenues from other corporations. And also it does relate to the market prices for those commodities, and that varies.
Kotzebue-based Nana Corporation pays in earnings from the Red Dog Mine, and Barrow-based Arctic Slope Corporation pays petroleum revenues. Two-thirds of the rest of the dividend comes from Sealeska business earnings. McNeil says that comes from manufacturing and government contracts.
Our federal contracting is Sealeska Environmental Services, which does remediation contracts, principally with the Department of Energy.
The remainder of the dividend comes from the corporation's permanent fund. Sealeska paid a smaller spring dividend in April. That and December's distribution add up to nearly $18 million for the year. About 60% of Sealeska's 20,000 shareholders belong to urban corporations such as Juneau's Gold Belt. Village corporations often pass on the revenue earnings to their shareholders, so they get the same total as urban shareholders. Sealeska opened its rolls to shareholders' descendants several years ago, and close to 4,000 have signed up. It also began offering an extra payment to elders, and about 2,000 have registered. Elders and descendants can still sign up for dividends and other shareholder benefits. The cutoff date for the December payment is November 19th. The Forest Service is overhauling its recreation plan and trying to involve communities in sustainable tourism. The pilot program in the Tongass is called the Sitka Sustainable Outdoor Recreation Plan. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The framework for sustainable tourism echoes the transition framework for economic development and timber harvesting created by the Tongass Futures Roundtable over the last couple of years. Both represent a change in direction for the Forest Service under the Obama administration. Deb Lyons, the director of Sitka Trailworks, the Forest Service's lead partner in the project, told the Sitka Chamber of Commerce that the effort resembled other local tourism planning projects with one big difference. This one was on the government's dime. The Forest Service has hired Anchorage-based consultant Agnew Beck to develop the plan. Three public meetings have already been held this fall in town to generate input. Cruise passengers, locals, and guides and other vendors have been surveyed. Lyons told the chamber that Alaskans were already more outdoor savvy than the lower 48 market. She said the idea was not to crowd out the activities that Sitkans already enjoy.
Our goal isn't to increase the use levels on all the trails so that locals are displaced. We're not going there at all. You know, we want to keep it compatible, and one of the things that came back in the visitor surveys is I think there was only one comment that identified any sort of conflict felt with the tours and the visitors that are currently on the trails. 99% of the people said, you know, I've been out on the trail system with visitors and with groups, and not a problem at this point. So we're hoping to keep using the management tools that are in place and keep the quality of experience very high for people who live here as well as for folks who come visit. But there does seem to be some underutilized opportunity there.
Those opportunities run the gamut in the plan, everything from better playgrounds to better information at the docks about local sightseeing to hut hiking and kayaking trails. Trailworks board member Charles Horan was in the audience for the presentation. He and his wife had just returned from a trip to New Zealand, where they hiked the 33-mile Milford Track. Great walks like the Milford Track can be the primary reason people will choose a destination. Horan suggested that sustainable recreation in Sitka included building a brand.
Does Sitka want to brand itself as one of the legs of the stools of its economy is, can people come here to really experience the Alaska they're dreaming and thinking and fantasizing about, not the jewelry stores? And I think this is a great opportunity, and I'm excited to see Sitka, you know, maybe emerge as a branded place for this type of stuff. And this is the process we need to get the community on board, because it can't be an agency or a group. It has to be a community desire to be that kind of brand.
Lyons illustrated some of the plan's goals by discussing Portland, Oregon, which has so successfully branded itself as an outdoor destination that outdoor gear companies have relocated there. She also pointed to a project underway to brand Anchorage and to the success of Moab, Utah, where 78% of the economy revolves around mountain bike tourism. Lyons admitted that she was trolling for business participation as the plan moves forward. A number of chamber members were eager to have a logo designed and to get started. Lyons suggested that all ideas were welcome, but at this stage, anything beyond planning might be premature.
It's identified we need to do something about Sitka branding, then it's everybody's ideas to do that. You know, this is the process where no one's in charge.
Lyons stressed that the framework for sustainable recreation was a 10-year action plan, and it was important to expand participation beyond her organization, Sitka Trail Works, and the U.S. Forest Service. She was looking to the National Park Service, the Sitka Convention and Visitors Bureau, the Sitka Economic Development Association, and the Sitka Tribe to all be involved. Tourism planning in Sitka has been problematic in the past. A months-long attempt by the Long Range Planning and Economic Development Commission to write a collaborative visitor industry plan several years ago ended in failure. Lyons said that one consistent answer in planning surveys given to local residents was to stay realistic. Lyons expected that Agnew Beck would have a draft plan prepared for release to the public this December. A final plan would roll out in the spring. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Responders are cleaning up a large diesel fuel spill north of Talkeetna following an accident involving a tanker trailer on the park's highway. Officials with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation estimate more than 2,500 gallons of diesel spilled in the mishap Thursday near mile 177. DEC says the big state logistics driver was hauling a 9,100-gallon tank and a 5,000-gallon pup tank north when the semi-trailer slid from the road. The driver was not hurt. Responders are also removing the remaining fuel in the tanks. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ben Stanton in Kenai, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Adam Kane in Dillingham, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by
Fire Island Wind, offering a fuel-free energy alternative to South Central Alaska natural gas. Learn more at fireislandwind.com.
APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.